It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Mike Arnold, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's a countdown in Congress to pass a spending bill by December 11th and prevent a government shutdown.
Now we're getting a firsthand look at how extreme weather events from the last few years have affected Wisconsin farmers.
Scientists say climate change means more extreme weather events like droughts, intense storms, and floods. We've already had a few of these extreme weather events in Wisconsin, so Clean Wisconsin decided to talk to one group of people directly affected by climate change, farmers.
Today, Clean Wisconsin released their findings in a new report. It's called Seeds of Challenge, a survey of how extreme weather impacts Wisconsin's agriculture. Katie Walter is here to talk about the report. She's the energy and climate specialist for Clean Wisconsin. Katie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So farmers have always had to deal with unpredictable weather, extreme weather. It's sort of the hallmark of what the weather is.
Right.
But how different is the story now for farmers in Wisconsin in what they're dealing with when it comes to weather?
Well, what we're hearing from farmers is that, like you said, yes, they're used to a bad summer here, or, you know, a real late spring here. But what's different now is that these events are coming on their one after the other. They're not getting that time to rest that they normally have between bad years. And it's really just hard. It's hard for them to ignore after one after the other, like we've had in the last few years.
And you went out and you actually spoke with the farmers firsthand to talk to them about what they experienced. And that's a lot of what this report is. What did they have to say?
Yeah, I've a lot of really interesting stories. Was very, very, very very informative for me myself. I did speak to one dairy farmer who was third generation dairy farmer in Wisconsin, and the drought in 2012 was the first time since the Dust Bowl that he had to buy feed for his cattle. So in his 35 years and his father's 50 years of farming, that had never happened before. That's one that sticks out for me. The other one that really sticks on the top of my mind is an apple orchard in northern Wisconsin, who he's in contact with all the other apple growers up there, and he's noticed that 1990, at that point, you know, most folks didn't have irrigation systems, but since then it is almost a necessity for them to put irrigation systems in. And obviously those are expensive systems, but they're also really time consuming for farmers to have to deal with them, and then of course you feel them in the pocketbook too when it comes to the utility bills.
So the farmers that you spoke to, did they draw a direct line between the weather events and the repercussions that you just talked about?
The purpose of this report was really to start the conversation about extreme weather and what we've seen in the last few years, because I think it really gives us a good taste of what we can expect in the future. We were sort of the silver lining to the bad weather in the last few years, you could say, was that we can start to look at what we need to be doing in the future to prepare for more events like these.
Were there farmers that you spoke to in different areas of the state? You mentioned some farmers up north, for instance. But did farmers in different parts of the states have different experiences and maybe have more of a typical kind of couple of years?
No, it really was across the board. You know, we talked to orchards near Bayfield, dairy beef cattle near Jefferson, vegetable farms in western Wisconsin, a garlic farmer near Milwaukee, poultry farms in Dane County. Really across the board, they had been seeing extreme weather that they had never seen before.
And how about things like CSAs? A lot of people do community-sponsored agriculture these days. How is this kind of weather affecting CSAs?
Yeah, one CSA we talked to during the heavy rains in 2008-2007, it was a smaller farm, I guess, in terms of smart farms, lost $1 million due to their from vegetables due to the loss. And some other things I heard from CSAs was that it was hard for their customers to understand what was happening. Let's say they went to the farmer's market and they saw some farms had plenty of produce sitting out there. And while they weren't able to supply what they normally would, it's sort of hard for us folks who don't work and deal with the weather in our daily lives to really understand how much it impacts farmers and how challenging it is. So that particular farm felt like the relationships with their customers was hurt that year.
Can we put a price tag on how much farmers might be losing because of extreme weather?
Yeah, well, like I was saying before, the past few years have really have taught us a lot. For example, the drought in 2012, again, lowered crop yields and drove up the cost of grain, which caused farmers in Wisconsin overall to spend $800 million more on inputs for things like feed, seeds, pesticides than they had the previous year. And then again, the next year, in 2013, the excessive moisture and rain resulted in $61.9 million in assistance payments from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to Wisconsin farmers, which is important because that was $52 million more than they paid out the year before.
So when you look at something, a severe weather event, a drought, a flood, how long-ranging is the impact of a single event like that on the farmer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Some of the dairy farms we heard from, the drought years, they're still recovering from that. It's, you know, they had to sell off cows that would have bred again, and it takes years for them to recover from that sort of an event.
Now, you mentioned farmers all around Wisconsin. We talked about an apple orchard and a dairy farmer. How about looking in Milwaukee, for instance, some of the more urban areas?
Well, just this morning I was talking to a garlic farmer outside of Milwaukee. He has specialty garlic, the kind of garlic with the hard stem that you find at the farmer's market. And he is having problems with early frost or late frost. They plant in the fall, and in previous years, you maybe wanted to mulch, maybe you didn't, it was up to you, but now it's a necessity, an absolute necessity, that they spend that time in the field in the fall.
Do you have any projections about, if this weather continues, extreme events, one after the other, how this will impact the agriculture industry here in Wisconsin?
That is a really good question, and that's the question is why we did this report. We're really hoping it starts the conversation about what we need to do in the future to make sure that we all have, you know, food on the table that we can afford, and that farmers are able to make livelihoods doing this work.
And in terms of what farmers themselves can do, is there any preventative action that they can be taking to protect their assets right now?
Well, I can tell you from the farmers I talked to, they are doing everything they can, and they're doing some incredibly hard work. But I think the silver lining is that farmers can actually be part of the solution. There's a lot of when it comes to climate change, farmers are leaders in renewable energy. We've got wind farms on and solar panels on farms across the state. And so I think that's sort of where we're looking to in the future, is farmers being the champions as well as the suppliers of our delicious, delicious food.
Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been speaking to Katie Walter, Energy and Climate Specialist for Clean Wisconsin. She was with us to talk about the group's new report on how extreme weather impacts Wisconsin's farmers.
It's time for our weekly look at what our lawmakers in Washington are up to. With USA Today politics editor Paul Singer, the government will shut down in 8 days if Congress doesn't pass a spending bill. That's the priority at the moment for the lame duck Congress.
And the House Intelligence Committee found late last month that there was no government wrongdoing in regard to the September 11th, 2012 terrorist attack in Benghazi. But a special Republican panel continues to investigate, and it's costing money. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, it's great to have you back.
Hi, Veronica. Happy post-Thanksgiving.
Happy post-Thanksgiving to you, too. So looking at December 11th, this looming deadline, what happens if Congress doesn't agree on a funding bill by then?
I quit my job and leave town. the funding bill runs until December 11th, and at that point, without any further action from Congress, government would begin to shut down again. The whole idea was that they would pass this bill until December, let the elections happen, and then pass a long-term spending bill that will extend until next September. Unfortunately, after President Obama made his announcement about executive action on immigration, a number of Republicans obviously were very upset by that maneuver and have now said, hold it, let's look at the spending bill and see if we can figure out a way to defund the immigration action when passing that bill. That creates a really interesting challenge, because obviously the president's not going to sign a bill that defunds his immigration action. So now we're back at the showdown again, is will Republicans pass a bill that the president can sign that will keep the government open? Drama and, you know, heavy music begins.
Right. So here we are, another moment of political brinksmanship. But the New York Times is reporting, interested to see whether you agree, that that shutting down the government and going too far with this is not something that might benefit Republicans.
Well, benefit or not is not sort of, I don't judge the benefit. It is very, very clear the Republican leadership has said they have no interest in a shutdown at all. There is a small group of Republicans who are very adamant about this, that they're going to fight this tooth and nail. But I don't think any of the Republicans really want to shut down the government. What they're probably going to try and do is find some way to extend the funding bill. One of the things they're talking about is, what if we fund everything for the rest of the year, except that is for the rest of the fiscal year 2015, except for the Department of Homeland Security, which is responsible for these immigration policies. That one we'll fund through maybe February, and that'll give us another chance to fight this out later. The other possibility is like maybe a symbolic vote. Maybe we can have a resolution that basically decries the president's action as an improper use of executive authority. It has no binding impact, but it allows Republicans to lodge their protest officially. That kind of thing might get us around an actual shutdown problem.
And what kind of message does that send, I guess, about the end of this year's Congress and about how things might change?
You know, I don't know. It's a very good question whether what this means. I mean, if we'll see in the next week, if John Boehner can get everybody in the room and say, people, we are not going to have another shutdown. We are not going to once again have a kind of, you know, mad scramble to solve these problems 2 weeks later. We're going to do this in an orderly fashion, and everyone's going to agree and get on board. If he can get them to do that, even if they're agreeing to a delay, you know, kick this off until February, for instance, it will suggest that Boehner has corralled the most rowdy of his caucus and has figured out a way to get them on board when needed. There was a real issue 6 months ago or a year ago, you know, getting all the Republicans on board. Now, what happens in January when the new Congress is actually in place and some of these people really want to make a name for themselves, I don't know. But an ability for Boehner to win this week with a sort of what you consider the institutional prerogative first would be a big thing and a big sign for them going forward.
Now, it doesn't sound like there's much appetite for there to be an actual government shutdown, but how far can both sides go with this before the country and Congress enters a sort of crisis siege mentality, the markets get affected, and we end in a new sort of emotional tenor about politics right now?
Well, it's pretty much always like that now, isn't it? I mean, I don't think we're going to get to that point. My suspicion is by the end of this week, we'll have a pretty clear path forward. I'm told that Speaker Boehner has a commitment. I believe he's attending the wedding of one of his staff members, like the 12th or 13th of December. And so he wants to be able to go to that wedding. He wants this to be over. So I believe we'll see this whole thing wrap up sometime at the end of this week. We'll have a clear resolution. Nobody wants to ruin Christmas. No one wants to ruin the holidays. And certainly, I think, as you say, nobody wants to throw the markets into a tailspin. So my suspicion is this will be resolved earlier rather than later. But, you know, sometimes I'm wrong, so who knows?
No.
No, wrong!
Not you, Paul.
Yeah, never.
Well, you know, moving on to another story, one that's been going on for a while. At the end of last month, the House Intelligence Committee found no government wrongdoing surrounding the September 11th, 2012 terrorist attack in Benghazi. How did they get to that decision?
Well, there's been several investigations in the House of Representatives and in the Senate as well, actually. Congress has been looking into this matter fairly vigorously. And what the House Intelligence Committee did, a two-year analysis and study, and they interviewed a lot of people. And what they said was essentially there was chaos on the ground. There was sort of a fog of war on the ground in Benghazi. It is true now, we believe, that most of the terrorist attack, the events on the ground there were by and large a terrorist attack by a pretty organized Al-Qaeda cell. The issue is at the very moment, it appeared maybe there were some protests, there was some intelligence that was coming through that was suggesting it might be different groups. There was a lot of confusion about exactly what had taken place. And so this committee report concluded that there was never a what they call a stand down order. There was nobody ordering the military not to go in and rescue Americans. There was no failure of intelligence. There was some confusion, but no failure. There was no intention to mislead on the part of the White House when they said, when they sort of said at the outset that they thought it was a response to a protest. So they basically debunked a whole bunch of the biggest allegations against the administration in this matter. Now, that doesn't necessarily make a difference because in May, Congress created a standalone committee to kind of reinvestigate the whole Benghazi affair. That is the Benghazi committee that I've been reporting on the past couple of weeks.
So how does their mission, this new special panel, differ from the old one?
Well,
the committee.
What they will say is, you know, the other committees that did this work all did it from their own perspective. So the Intelligence Committee was looking into intelligence issues. The military, the Armed Forces Committee was looking into how did the Pentagon respond. What this committee says they're doing is sort of bringing that all to one place and telling a coherent story from start to finish about what actually happened that day. They also say that they have, you know, hired some federal prosecutors who will be able to get better sources and better information and more detail. So they think that their mission is, and the Republicans have said pretty clearly, the mission of this committee is to finally and completely tell the story of the attack on the U.S. compound in Benghazi. Democrats say it's a tremendous waste of time and money because there's no real unanswered questions left. We already know what happened, and nobody's really at specific fault.
And you recently wrote a story about this, about the new special panel and the amount of money it's costing. How much does it cost?
At the moment, they will end up spending about $1.5 million this year. But remember, they weren't set up until June or July. And even then, they've been sort of hiring up gently through the year. And they've only had one public hearing. Their second public hearing is next week. They are now at the rate where they've got about 23 or 24 employees. It's about the size of the Veterans Affairs Committee on Capitol Hill. And it is spending at about a rate of $250,000 a month, which means that next year, if this thing runs for a whole other year, it will be a $3 million committee, which is pretty good money to spend on a House committee. It is not my job to judge whether that is a good or a bad expenditure of taxpayer resources, but that's what it will cost. And again, it will end up being about the same size and about the same cost as the Veterans Affairs Committee.
Can you frame this for us in terms of Congress right now? Is this seen as primarily political theater, or is this something that constituents, they want a cohesive narrative out of Benghazi?
Well, it depends on who you ask, obviously. I mean, there are a lot of people who still believe that Benghazi is, you know, a great cover-up of the Obama administration. And keep in mind, the reason that Benghazi is a lively topic in political circles is because at the top of the State Department at the time was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who may very well be a Democratic presidential candidate in 2016. So any opportunity to find fault with the Obama administration on Benghazi is also an opportunity to find fault with Hillary Clinton and use it against her in a presidential campaign if there is one. But, you know, you certainly can't dismiss the idea of good fact-finding by Congress in what was a really tragic event overseas and the death of a U.S. ambassador, I believe, for the first time since the 1970s, on post overseas. So the question for other minds, not me, is whether this is really the appropriate use of those kind of investigative resources. I do not know. What I do know is that there are certain parts of the Republican Party, particularly, that believe there is much more of a story to tell about Benghazi and that would have reason to benefit from a continuation of this investigation.
Now, before we let you go, yesterday the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation met to talk about domestic violence within pro sports. What happened there?
Well, interestingly, the major commissioners of the major leagues didn't show up, but they had some, you know, high-profile people who could talk about what sports are doing to address domestic violence. You know, Congress doesn't really have a lot of authority to do much here. They every now and then threaten to, you know, I don't know, revoke the whatever it is the leagues have this exemption from antitrust laws and stuff. You know, there's a bunch they can threaten to do, but it's really just an opportunity for Congress to bring attention an important social issue and to raise the pressure on these leagues to do something about it. And I think in the wake of the Ray Rice matter, in your part of the country, obviously the Adrian Peterson, the running back for the Vikings, there are enough high-profile cases that I think the NFL certainly feels very singed by this issue and really feels a need to get out in front of it. I don't know that Major League Baseball and the Basketball Association have really had cases that have been so high-profile that have made them want to reconsider their positions, but that's sort of why Congress does these things. Not because they're going to pass a bill, not because they're going to, be able to take away their birthday, but because they're going to be able to use that spotlight to draw further attention to the issue. Now, I'll say, as a flip side to that, that hearing went on and it didn't get a lot of attention. It really was not a very high-profile hearing, and, it has not been on the front page of any newspaper, so I don't know how well it did at that, attempt to draw attention.
And we leave it there. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us, and have a great week.
Thanks, Veronica. Talk to you later.
We've been speaking to Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to give us the latest scoop on our lawmakers in Washington.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. About 2.5 million Americans were deployed in some way in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, according to the Department of Defense data. Today, the war in Iraq has ended, and the war in Afghanistan is coming to a close. And the veterans of those wars are facing new challenges as they return home.
A new seminar this semester at UW-Stevens Point called Back from the Front, Transitioning from the Military to Civilian Life, is dedicated to helping veterans who are now enrolled at Stevens Point.
The seminar was in part inspired by a 2012 book by Iraq War veteran Brian Kastner. It's called The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. Brian was an officer in explosive disposal unit in Iraq and returned home to find panic and anxiety gripping his life.
David Krissinger is with us. He's an associate lecturer at UW-Stevens Point and created the seminar dedicated to veterans transitioning to student life. David, welcome.
Thank you.
And also joining us is author Brian Kastner. He's visiting UW-Stevens Point today to speak with veterans and give a public lecture. Brian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now, Brian, you commanded an explosive disposal unit in Iraq. That can be very dangerous work, and that was really what inspired your book, I suppose. What was it like to defuse bombs and handle debris day after day?
I guess I spent a whole book trying to describe that. I tried to. For me, it didn't make a sense to write a book that was only about the war or only about coming home, and I kind of intertwined those two things. And so the funny thing about war, the funny thing about taking apart bombs in Iraq is it can be frightening, but it's also exhilarating. And so when you're coming home, you're both thankful to be safe, but then you also have this incredible experience that you just naturally miss it in some way. And so that can inform your ability to come home, just deal with normal tasks. How does walking the dog and doing the dishes rise to the challenge of taking apart IEDs with a robot? It doesn't. And in that way, I guess the book speaks to a lot of veterans' experiences.
And the title of the book, The Long Walk, is basically referring to when you'd have to suit up and go up to a piece of explosive debris or a bomb. Is that right.
We've been in the bomb disposal community. We've been using the term the long walk for decades. The British called it that during the Troubles in Northern Ireland as well. And the idea is that unlike what you might see in the movies, you only go up to a bomb as the last resort, the last thing you would possibly want to do. You've used a robot first. You've used explosive first. You've done lots of things first. But then if it really comes down to it, somebody has to take the thing apart, right? So you put on the suit, and only one person is going to go down, so only one person is exposed to the danger, and it's the longest, loneliest thing you can do. But, of course, titles have multiple meanings, so it's not just
– Yeah, I was going to say, is that also what it's like coming back after war, too? It feels like a long walk?
It does. It feels like a very long transition, and it's also lonely. You can be – despite the fact that, as you mentioned, there's 2.5 million veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, it can feel like you're doing it by yourself. You've had this unit. You've had these men and women that you've been closer to than family while you've been in combat together. And then in my case, I went home to Buffalo, New York, and there's not a lot of bomb techs in Buffalo. And so you're on your own, and it feels lonely the way, you know, that did, the long walk did too.
And in the book, you describe yourself as sort of dealing with the crazy. Could you talk about that a little bit? Is it just getting used to the different situation in being home?
It was a lot of things. I used the word crazy because I didn't have another word for it. And I should say crazy is my word, with a capital C. I use it. And I think there's a lot of fear among a lot of veterans that you don't want to come home and be the crazy veteran. And I felt like I was turning into a stereotype or a cliche or something. So for me, it's anxiety, but it's not just that. It's stress. It's worry. It's the challenge of transitioning. For me, it was also a physical feeling. I thought I was having a heart attack. And the only reason I ended up at the right place in the VA is because I had been to the emergency room so many times, they got sick of looking at me. And they eventually sent me to all the stress tests. And if it's not your heart, it turned out to be, to be my head. And it took me a bit of a transition to kind of work through all that.
Now this is a transition that a lot of people are dealing with as they come back from war. And David Christinger, I want to bring you in now. You're the lecturer at Stevens Point that started this seminar focused on veterans transitioning to student life. Could you tell me how this all started with you?
About 4.5 years ago, a very good friend of mine came home from his second combat deployment. He went to Iraq first, Afghanistan second, and late one night, he opened up to me about some of the issues that he was dealing with. And I remember realizing, in 2010, we had been at war for 9 years, and I had not ever really been confronted with the after effects. And I realized that I didn't know about the places he was talking about, and I didn't know about the issues that he was dealing with. And so I started reading everything I could so that I could talk to him and in an intelligent way, I guess. And there were a few books that I read that really, made me understand, I think, a little bit better, or at least allowed me to empathize a little bit better with his situation. Brian's book was one of those books. And
So you're not a veteran. So being able to figure that out was a challenge.
Right. Yep. I come from a family of veterans. My father is a veteran. My grandfather fought in the Pacific during World War II. And so I had that sort of family background. But no, I myself never served. And when my friend came back, like I said, it was difficult to confront that and realize that I had not paid attention for almost a decade. And so he and I, I'm a writer, editor, and he and I worked together for a few years trying to tell his stories and writing them down. And we had this like pile of paper of all the stuff that we had written. And we thought, okay, now what do you do with this? And we decided to start a website and do a fundraiser for a organization that helps veterans in their transition. And we ran a 50-mile ultramarathon last October after raising $7,000 for The Mission Continues, which is this really great nonprofit out of St. Louis that helps veterans transition by giving them leadership opportunities in their communities. And a couple of weeks before that race, we were invited to come to the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, to do a lecture in a class called Running in the Meaning of Life, which was just perfect for what we were doing. And after the class was over, a few people approached me and said, could you do a class based on what you did with your friend? And that's where the idea came from. And so I've spent the last year putting together a syllabus and trying to get guest speakers and people who have gone through this transition to come in and speak to my class.
Now David, apparently this is an issue that a lot of students are dealing with. A lot of students who are coming to UW-Stevens Point, there are a lot of returning veterans. So there was a need for this, right?
Yeah, we have about 300 student veterans on campus. And as part of the new curriculum design here, students are required to take what's called a first-year seminar, and basically it's a class to teach freshman students how to be successful in college, and the one thing that they found was that this was not particularly helpful necessarily for non-traditional students in general and veterans in particular, because the things that veterans are dealing with are very different than what the average 17 or 18-year-old is dealing with, and so the class was designed just for veterans. To give them a space to connect with each other and to build accountability and to learn how to be successful in the university environment.
Now, Brian Kastner, does this sound like a good idea to you based on your experience with your fellow veterans?
Oh, sure it does, because I think that there's this perception, there's a popular perception, based on a lot of media reports, that you can describe veterans only by post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, or traumatic brain injury, TBI, or the backlog of the VA, or all of these big problems. And you can get this impression that veterans are all crazy. They all have PTSD. They all have brain damage or something. But I think if you look at the wide group, really what a lot of veterans need is a transition. They don't need they need a community. They need they were used to having this bond in the military unit, and then they get to a university and it just feels different. They're, as David mentioned, they're with a lot of students that aren't very knowledgeable about the war, aren't necessarily sure what all of these veterans have been up to for the last 13 years. And so there is a bit of a transition involved there. And it's not about mental health counseling, or it's not specifically about something medical. It's about community. And that's what they're able to provide in this class and in their veterans club here and in, a number of other programs.
Now, Brian, when you were writing your book, were you imagining that other veterans would read this, or even people who weren't veterans would read this and be inspired by it in this way?
Oh, I had no idea. I was so naive. I thought I was writing this little story of something that happened to me and to some of my friends. And I didn't have an agent or a publisher or anything when I got started. So I was just amazed that anybody would want to read it. And then the fact that, it's been 2.5 years since the book was published, that I'm still talking about it, but not just that, that it continues to be relevant. And the most humbling thing, and the thing I never expected, is that veterans would read it and say, you know what? What you wrote about yourself makes sense to me and applies. And I would never want to speak for any individual veteran. Every veteran saw their own war, fought their own war, had their own experience. But if somebody says, hey, this does sound like me, it's tremendously gratifying, right?
Yeah. We're speaking with Brian Kastner. He's the author of The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows, and David Krissinger, associate lecturer at UW-Stevens Point, who leads a seminar designed for veterans transitioning to student life. And this seminar uses Brian's book and other books as a way to connect.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience of yourself, maybe a family member, coming back from war? What were the challenges with that transition, and how did you cope? If you return from war to become a student, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with Brian Kastner, author of The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. And also joining us is David Krissinger, associate lecturer at UW-Stevens Point, who leads a seminar designed for veterans transitioning to student life. The seminar was in part inspired by Brian's book. And we're talking about the challenges of coming home from war and transitioning to life as a student.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience of you or a family member coming back from war and dealing with making that transition? What are the challenges and coping mechanisms? If you return from war to become a student, we'd like to hear from you. Talk about your unique challenges. Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Brian Kastner, it was interesting, before we went to the news, you were talking about how you were surprised that other people that other people's experiences were similar to yours. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. I had no agenda or platform when I was writing this. I didn't have a lot of writing experience. I had written a little bit, but I wasn't plugged into the publishing world. I had not written a lot of other things, and so I guess I didn't really anticipate, the audience it might find. And in that way, I'm just really fortunate. I think that if you're really lucky as a writer, your book is two books. Your book is the book you thought you wrote, and then your book is also this book that it turns into as other people read it and share it. And it's a tremendous gift for the writer for that to happen. And that only happens if you find an audience. And so So yeah, since then, I've become much more conversant on veterans' issues and have done the research to educate myself. But I didn't write it as a, I don't know, as any sort of policy book of here's what we should do for veterans. All I tried to do was tell a little story. And I think that as a writer, you get to the general when you become very, very specific. So this is one story of one person in Iraq, but you can maybe draw some broader themes from that. And I guess not to give away the ending of my book, but I don't have PTSD, you know, so there's more to this. The story is more complicated than person goes to war, person comes back crazy, person is broken. There's a lot more variations in gray area in there. And, you know, different veterans need different things.
Now, David Kreisinger, you deal with veterans in the course that you're teaching. Do you find that that's the situation with the students you're working with who are making a transition from being soldiers to being students?
Absolutely. You know, I would say the number one thing that I've learned in this semester is exactly what Brian said, that every veteran fought their own war, and they're all going to have to find their own path home. And one path is not going to be right for every veteran. And I think that was, you know, I had sort of come into the semester thinking, you know, Brian ran. He ran to sort of deal with the things he was doing with or that he was dealing with. And he wrote and he, you know, learned history and learned about, you know, the veterans who came before him and the things they dealt with. And I thought, that's a great model. I'm going to do that. I'm going to start a running group and we're going to write and we're going to study history. And for some, that's exactly what they needed. And others say, no, this isn't exactly what I need. Or maybe it's, you know, it's something a little bit different. Or, you know, maybe I need, we read another book called Turning Pro, that's all about doing the little things every day and focusing on being a professional. And that really resonated with some of the students. And I found like throughout the semester that if I could just say, hey, you know, if we look at history and we see what other veterans have done, you know, maybe this can give you an idea of what would work for you. And I think the students have really responded to that.
Well, we'd like to hear from you if you're listening and have thoughts about this. Maybe you were a returning veteran at some point and went off to college, or maybe you just want to talk about coming back to the United States after being overseas as a soldier. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We are going to go to the phones right now. Matt from Sparta, welcome to Central Time. Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I was an active duty airborne infantryman for a little more than 3 years in the 82nd Airborne Division, got deployed a couple times with them, and I was fortunate enough, and I never take it for granted, that although I was an infantryman, I didn't see anything that was sufficiently traumatic to cause me any kind of issues coming back home, so I can't speak to that. However, I was concerned coming back and going to school. I'm a full-time student right now, as well as a reservist. I was concerned that I would have certain viewpoints forced on me by my professors in college, and that has not happened. So that's really awesome. That's not been an issue, and I've actually been to a couple different campuses in Wisconsin as a full-time student. I've never experienced that. Also, I was concerned that I would have issues utilizing the benefits, the Montgomery GI Bill and whatnot. Once I started going to school, and that has not been an issue either. The people who work for the veterans representatives on the college campuses have all done a really good job, and you know, so I'm pretty
and so Matt, in your case, having people who can help you and sort of finding a community that can help you is really paid off for you in a lot of ways then.
Absolutely. Yeah, the you know, there's veteran student organizations that I've taken part in, and those are extremely helpful in navigating, you know, the different specific concerns veterans might have as college students, as well as the paid staff whose job it is to make sure that the veterans are getting their, you know, benefits, whether it be, you know, Montgomery GI Bill or post-9/11 or whatever it might be. So it's been a positive experience for me, and
all right. Well, thanks, Matt, for that call. And Brian Kastner, was finding some sort of community or finding some way of working through the issue a really key point for you when you came back?
It was. I mean, I tried a lot of things. Like David mentioned, I tried running. I still run a lot. I did yoga. Obviously, writing helped. And as David said, and as Matt alluded to, you know, everybody's kind of figuring out their own way to transition back. I think something Matt said, though, is really important. And that's that he had his suspicions about going back to college, too. And there's a name for this, the civilian military divide that exists in our country now, where we have a very, very few, less than 1% of the population that went and fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we have a country that, well, paid more or less attention to it, depending on what year it was. And so we have these, if they're not suspicions, they're at least just basic ignorance, kind of on both sides. The veteran is maybe, like Matt mentioned, he was suspicious of, well, what am I going to learn in these colleges? And on the other hand, you have civilians saying, well, who are these veterans and what did they do? And I'm not sure what to ask them. Do I thank them from their service? Do I not thank them? Do I talk to them? And really, it's classes like David's and it's programs at universities around the country that maybe start individual one-on-one conversations. And that's how we bridge this divide.
Well, Brian Kastner, thank you so much. David Kristinger, too. Thanks for joining us. We've been speaking with Brian Kastner, author of The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows, and David Kristinger, associate lecturer at UW-Stevens Point, who leads a seminar designed for veterans transitioning to student life. Brian Kastner will be giving a lecture tonight at 6 p.m. at the Dreyfus University Center at UW-Stevens Point. If you're a returning veteran, a great resource is the Veterans Coming Home website. It's a project led by our colleagues at Wisconsin Public Television with partnerships with public media organizations across the country. The address for that is veteranscominghome.org. That's veteranscominghome.org. Again, a service of Wisconsin Public TV and public media stations across the country.